June 9th, 2021. 25 years of Abhayagiri honoring our elders retreat. And our elders have gone to take a bit of a rest. And it's been a long day. So it's the Upasita day as well. And June 9th is also a special day for me because my nephew turned two today. My sister sent a picture of him waving a balloon in the air. It's always fun to see those pictures. It's nice to see everybody here together practicing. And it was also nice to do those forest walking meditations. And so often people come here to Abhayagiri and they come and just practice in the cloister area, or people come as day visitors and they're just here in the area, perhaps offering food or making offerings of requisites to the Sangha, but never really get to see the forest and really what makes up the majority of the land at Abhayagiri, which is this rugged mountain wilderness that we have here. And there are things in nature that could be of danger to us here, but if we respect them, then we're safe. So we have deer, and there were some baby turkeys on the second forest walk today. You couldn't really see them so well, but there was some brush they were in, and the mother turkeys, they hide their eggs really, really well. It's actually really difficult to find turkey eggs, wild turkey eggs. But there were these hatchlings, you could hear them. And there's lizards and bobcats, and there's bears and mountain lions. There's also rattlesnakes. There's been some rattlesnakes sighted, so we just have to be careful of that. That's just part of living in the forest. And as long as we're careful of the rattlesnakes, they don't really want to have anything to do with us. The rattlesnakes are actually quite good. They've got this little rattle to warn you that you're getting near them. So as far as poisonous snakes go, the rattlesnakes are quite safe in that they warn you. And as long as you keep a distance from them, then you're safe. So you show that respect to them, and then it's fine. I was actually doing some raking around my kuti a couple days ago in the afternoon, and was doing some fire clearance raking, so doing raking on the parts of the forest around the cabin that don't normally get raked, so it's quite thick with leaves. And sometimes when you do that kind of thing, you discover things. So I discovered a sandal from a previous occupant that had been living there. I uncovered some of the history of that kuti. I don't know which previous occupant that would be, either Ajahn Yatiko or Ajahn Kurudamo, or perhaps even Ajahn Amaro. It was a very old sandal, and it was under multiple layers of leaves, but definitely a monk sandal from years ago. It had been just sitting there. And then soon after discovering that sandal, there was a lot of leaves falling. It was windy, and went over to do some raking on the actual clear part. It was a little boundary area between the area that's clear around the immediate hut there, and then the boundary between the immediate hut and then where there's a lot of leaves that doesn't normally get raked. And I was raking that boundary area and heard this little ch-ch-ch-ch, and I was raking a snake. I raked a snake. So I jumped back and picked the rake up, and the rattlesnake went off some other direction. But I almost raked a rattlesnake into myself. It was very camouflaged and sitting in the leaves there. So the theme of this retreat, honoring elders, and Longpo Pasano gave the talk earlier today, both about the history of Abhayagiri, but also in honor of Longpo Sumedho. Talked a lot about Longpo Sumedho and how Lumpur Cha told the Western monks, you know, you all have to be grateful for Lumpur Sumedho. He's like the tank that went and cleared the way beforehand. It's a, if you can think of this military imagery, it's like the tank going out and clearing out the troops, the enemy troops, before you can send in everybody else. So he's there on the front lines. And also that Master Xuanhua said that Ajahn Sumedho is the most senior American bhikkhu. He's not the most senior Western bhikkhu. There was other more senior German and British bhikkhus in the world, but he's the most senior American bhikkhu, unless there's somebody secretly we don't know about. But Master Xuanhua said that Ajahn Sumedho is the most senior American bhikkhu. So really someone who paved the way for us. And for myself, I'm always blown away whenever I meet, whenever I have encounters or meet up with Lumpur Sumedho, whether it's in Thailand or, you know, or whether it's just meeting up somehow for myself as a new abbot. I do have that perk of being able to actually call Lumpur Sumedho and get encouragement from him. And so I did make use of that invitation, and that last November, that was very helpful. One thing that was very helpful in terms of advice that he gave to me, and was I asked him what, you know, I feel bad sometimes, and I feel like quite awful actually when the mind, you know, if I like develop resentment toward like a teacher or a senior monk, if they say something I don't like, or just you know, somehow there's some difficulty in terms of like a senior monk, like, and I develop like I get irritated by them or develop like a sense of resentment towards them, and I said I feel quite bad about that, and how do I rectify that kind of situation? And then I asked him, did you ever get irritated by Lumpur Cha? Because, you know, Lumpur Cha, we see Lumpur Cha as like this mythical figure in our tradition now, but it was actually, could be quite difficult to live with him, and actually he would really test people and really push people outside of their comfort zone of what they were mentally and physically comfortable with, and try to get them to look at the dukkha that gave rise to. And so Lumpur Sumedho said, well, yes, there was times when I hated Lumpur Cha. I had incredible resentment. And I said, well, how did Lumpur Cha react to that? Like, was he upset with you? Was he upset with you when you had, like, when he could tell you had resentment toward him? And he said, no, he just wanted me to see what my mind was doing. It didn't affect him. He just wanted us to see what our minds were doing. So yeah, I actually found that quite helpful. But also any time I've been able to meet up with Lumpur Sumedho, and I'm sure others have had this experience as well, just feeling the metta and the compassion. And also he's got a lot of humility, so he's always downplaying his own barami. So in a way it makes him very, very easy to relate to and easy to speak to as a, you know, one-on-one. I remember last time meeting up in person in Thailand, December 2019, January 2020, traveling in Thailand with Lumpur Pasano, and we met up with Lumpur Sumedho at Damaram, and again getting advice from him, kind of, okay, Do you have any advice for me going back to a bikery? And then I remember it was really good, just him say coming back to awareness, coming back to taking refuge in awareness when things are difficult. Go back to awareness of the situation rather than the details of a difficult situation or trying to, you can't always solve situations. Sometimes you just have to go back to the awareness of the situation. But then I asked him some advice about a particular situation which might be difficult in the future. And then he said, well, I have to say I didn't deal so skillfully with that particular situation, so I can't give you advice on that. It's like, good luck. But it's like the honesty in that is that was the best thing to hear for me. You know, it wasn't like he could give me the right advice on everything. Like, good luck with that. Sorry, can't help you there. So that advice to come back to awareness when we feel outside of our comfort zone or things are pushing us in various ways, or we feel like things go wrong, or there's a problem that we can't solve, then what do we take refuge in? So that training ourselves to take refuge in awareness. And I feel that's very important. And, this particular retreat, things are so much different now, you know, with the technology and with this particular talk is being live streamed on YouTube, and there's a few people who have joined in for this evening on Zoom. The main part of the retreat is 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., so there's more people on Zoom at that time. But when I first came here in the first several years I was here, we never even dreamed of live streaming and evening puja. This is something completely new, and it's a different experience. So as time goes on, we're in a different mode, and there may be a time in the future when live streams are no longer a thing and we don't do that kind of thing anymore. But then this is where we're at right now, and we're trying it out and seeing how it works, seeing if it's helpful. I found today I was quite tired today, having stayed up a bit last night and doing some final setups for this particular retreat, and then getting up early, and we had an early Padimokkha. So we had our Padimokkha ceremony down below here in the dining hall at the Ajahn Karunadhammo, chanting the Padimokkha, chanting a very good Padimokkha, very fast. And then having some breakfast, and then going with more retreat setup and testing. And some of this tech stuff, there's a lot of moving parts. So even though we have simplified our system greatly, and it's actually very streamlined right now and quite a bit easier to use than it was, still it can be a bit stressful, that sense of a lot of different moving parts and things to be aware of. So it can get stressful and frustrating, or sometimes something doesn't go quite right or we want it to be better. But at that time, it's just coming back to awareness and just having things, putting things in perspective, just that, well, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's at a certain point, we just say good enough and we just go with however it is in the moment. So with anything in life, we just have to do it like that. So that's what our elders teach us here over the years. It's fun to think about the old days. So like now I think of when I got here, even though maybe I'm not old per se, like, you know, you don't look at me and say like, oh, he's old. But you know, I think of when I first got here as the old days, and this particular gesture is something that Westerners do, as well, the air quotes. We had Ajahn Sek here for a while, and I remember him. He approached me one day and he said, "What does this mean when the Westerners do this? Like, what does that mean?" And I said, "Well, what I said, Ajahn, what do you think it means? Like, what were you telling yourself it means?" He said he thought it was like giving a blessing. He thought it was like, that's how like a Westerner like gives a blessing to somebody. That was his perception as a Thai monk coming. But yeah, the old days. When I came here, I was 20, and I'm 40 now. So you could say 20 years ago, that it was much different here. And I do remember teachings that, of course, the co-abbots at that time, Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro, and teachings they would give, saying, "Well, you know, people talk about the old days, but now is the old days of the future." So that's so true. Thinking back, yeah, they said that then, and they were right. You know, so we think of that as the old days now. And back then, when it was the new days, when back in 2001, and they would talk about the old days as the 1970s or the 1980s, you know, that was the good old days when the practice was happening at Wat Nong Papong, and the monks were putting forth effort. And back then, 1970s, 1980s, they talked about the old days as when the real practice was happening with Ajahn Mun and his disciples. So there's always this sense of the old days, but we really have to, whatever we like about the old days, we take that into the present. So if there's something we're inspired by the good old days of Buddhism or of the practice, then we try to take that into the present. That's the best we can do, and we take that into awareness, take refuge in awareness, whether it's the old days or the new days or the future. We take refuge in awareness. That's all we're trying to do. And this time now, time just keeps rolling on and on like a wheel, and we might think like we might suffer a lot over what's happening in society right now. And that's understandable. There's always something to suffer over if we look for it or don't take refuge in awareness. If we don't take refuge in awareness, but we look elsewhere, then there's what we see as suffering, what we see as dukkha everywhere. But this time in history is just a blip on the screen, just like any other time in history. We're actually quite fortunate to be here. I know Ajahn Pasano was mentioning earlier today, there's this big global catastrophe pandemic, but not a single one of us in the monastery can say, "Oh, I was so hungry the past year," or I can't, we didn't get food for such and such period of time, so we were still incredibly well supported. So it's pretty unbelievable. In the time of Ajahn Mun, World War II, even robe cloth was hard to come by. They actually had to wear rag robes. There was no other choice. Here we might be inspired by rag robes and take on that dutanga of wearing what we call Pangsukala Chivarang, which is the robes taken from a refuse heap, or rags taken from a refuse heap. It's one of the allowable ascetic practices that the Buddha laid out for bhikkhus, and that cloth from a refuse heap and washed and sewn together, rag robes. That's all they had. They didn't have a choice. So nowadays we might have a choice in terms of, we're inspired by that, and we might go up to the scrap cloth bin and in the Bhikkhu Commons up above and take some scrap cloth and hand sew a rag robe, and that's really good. That is frugal. That's praiseworthy and good to do. But it's good to remember in the time of Ajahn Mun, They didn't have a choice. They literally couldn't get cloth at times in the 1930s, 1940s. So that whole time period, cloth was hard to come by, food was hard to come by. There was famines. And they still made do. They still were able to practice. So how much more so are we able to practice with that unbelievable support that we get? We're incredibly fortunate. So it's good to cultivate compassion and to be aware of the suffering in the world, you know, especially a time like this. And at the same time to know that it's not any different from any other time in history. You know, so, and that it's still better, it's still more comfortable than, say, a time of famine, for example, when people don't actually have food to eat. So we have we're at a time in history right now, at Abayagiri, we have the luxury of being able to choose different foods to eat, and we can choose different diets that might work for us. But in a time of famine, the thought of a special diet wouldn't really occur to one at all. Just want to get food. You just want to get something, anything just to survive, anything just to keep living. So it's a good recollection, a recollection of support and developing that sense of gratitude as well. That I know that word gratitude in Pali, katanyu katawedi, it's a very interesting word because that word includes kata, which means to do. So there's a sense of action about that word. So katanyu, anyu is like knowing. Katanyu is just like acknowledging that which was done. And then katawedi is like that impulse or that desire to give back. So gratitude is more than appreciation. Appreciation is a feeling of thankfulness. So a feeling of appreciation. But then gratitude or katanyu katawedi is that impulse to give something back. And so that's also a theme of this particular retreat. There's that impulse to want to give something to help, somehow help people to practice, help people to cultivate the path. It's kind of fun to think about all the practice that has happened here as well. So all of the all-night sits that have happened here. Early days, we did the all-night sits in the house. There was a house with carpet in it, a little bungalow. And anybody who's watched the slideshow will see those early on pictures from 1996, 1997 with the house in its first incarnations. And there's a few shots, and if you were to pause those shots, you could see our little kitchen with its linoleum floor and four burner little podunk stove and one little tiny sink for washing dishes. I remember as an Anagarika, Katina, and just washing dishes, and then the dishes were appearing faster than I could wash them. And so there just kept being more and more dishes, because not only is there a big meal, and there wasn't that many Anagarikas. There was two Anagarikas at the time. And there was not really much room for more than two or three people to do dishes. So even if there was a lot of dishes, you couldn't really have a lot of people doing dishes or even cleaning up in the kitchen, because you could only fit four people in the kitchen before you're bumping up against each other. And so I remember just doing dishes, and the dishes kept piling up. So, okay, so it's noon, going to the kitchen after the meal, 1 p.m., 2 p.m., more and more dishes. And they're not stopping. There's robe sewing happening because it's Katina. Well, there's a Katina ceremony, then there's robe sewing, then through the afternoon there's allowables offered, and the dishes just kept coming. And I remember just making this determination, I'm just going to, even if I have to do dishes forever, I'm just going to keep doing dishes. I'm just going to not stop doing dishes until there's no more dishes. There's just not a single dish left. I'm just going to keep doing dishes. And I did dishes till evening time, till it was dark. And finally, they stopped. I just remember doing dishes for so long, just for hours, just doing dishes. So just those kind of memories. And then the all-night sits, and I remember it wasn't always clear. I remember being in Anagarika, and it wasn't always clear like what I was supposed to be doing. The instructions weren't always that clear. And I found out later that's like a Wat Pa Pong house style, that they don't give much instruction to the Anagarikas. They kind of watch them and see how they act in different situations. And that's, since the time of Longpo Cha, that's been kind of a house style of Anagarika training. And it just kind of seems to naturally continue in the monasteries now, just because that's kind of what was set in place. And I didn't know that I had to request to be a novice, that there was this thing about like requesting, that they don't just make you a novice. But I was in Thai, they call Grangjai, so I didn't want to ask. I wanted to become a novice, but I was like, oh, maybe it's like wrong to ask. And then it was getting closer and closer to being an Anagarika for 1 year. And I remember after a all-night sit, and we would sit in the house and have breakfast on the day after Wanpra, and I was sitting in there, and Ajahn Amaro was in there. And it was getting really close, and I was kind of like thinking, like, are they going to make me a novice or not? And finally, Ajahn Amaro was very compassionate and said, you know, if you want to become a novice, you have to request it. And said, yes, yes, I request it. Requested it right away. So, okay, duly noted. That's something he said a lot, duly noted. So staying up so many Wanpra nights, so many vigils. And I remember 9/11 happened when I was in Anagarika. That was a day after Wanpra, and we were all kind of bleary, having been up all night. And I remember we had a midnight tea discussion previous to that. And I remember that the midnight tea discussion was around, is there such a thing as collective karma? And they said, oh, yes, of course. And somehow that discussion went toward World War II and different battles in World War II and the possible karmic results of those battles. And then it's kind of an unusual midnight tea discussion. And they're always unusual, but this was extra unusual. And then the next morning, just remember being very tired and seeing the guest monk was really, we had one computer for the monastic community. The abbots had their own computers in their abbot's office, which was like a little side bedroom in the house. That was the abbot's office. But then Debbie, I think Debbie had a computer, and then there was one computer for the rest of the community. And the guest monk had first dibs on that computer. So guest monk was checking some stuff, and I saw the news coming in. So that was a point in history. That was a blip on the screen, and I remember it entering my mind, like, this is it. All right. World's going to end. You're going to blow everything up, and there's going to be a huge nuclear war or something, and it's over. And then I remember going up to my kuti that night and feeling really sad that it was all over. I'd convinced myself of this perception, and then when I was up at my kuti in the evening time, I was living in the gypsy caravan at the time, which is a trailer that we still have. It's in a different location now. But I was living in the gypsy caravan. And then there was little earthquakes, like oh, this is it. Like, San Francisco's gone. They just blew up San Francisco. And I had this image of, like, nuclear bombs in my mind. And we live on a fault line here, so it was just little earthquakes. It was just a coincidence. It was just these little earthquakes that were happening that just happened that day. I convinced myself that the world was ending. Then, of course, that was not the case. So it's pretty easy to convince ourselves of things like that. It's something completely different. It was these little earthquakes happening on the Laughlin Fault, which runs along Tomkai Creek here. So it's always not sure. That's one thing our elders teach us, that it's not sure what's actually happening. Even if we convince ourselves that things are a certain way, being convinced doesn't make it a reality. Being very sure about something doesn't make it a reality. So it's always not sure. In Buddhism, we always keep coming back to not sure. That's one aspect of impermanence, that anicca can be seen as impermanence or inconstancy, but it can also be seen as uncertainty. There's that different angle to it. It's very important. That's a very important aspect of practice, to be open in that way. And that allows the punya, the wisdom, the discernment. The discernment can start to develop, so that we don't get stuck in our own self-created cages of perception. That's something our elders teach us. And that's something since the time of the Buddha. That's definitely a legacy, that discernment, that ability to step out of our self-created structures and our self-created patterns and take a look at them and take refuge in awareness. So that's very, very important. So we have this period of time, just one day in history. We have a few days, we have 9 days to come together and practice. It's a very good opportunity. And whether we feel peaceful or not, and like remembering what Longpo Cha would say, if you're peaceful, it's good. If you're not peaceful, it's good. You're practicing. So just seeing it and being open to the experience, letting the experience unfold, the Sila Samadhi Panya, just getting on with the training, letting it unfold, seeing where it takes us. And there's it's a fairly sabai or comfortable schedule with no 5 a.m. puja each day, just the day starting at, for everybody here, for the lay guests, we're going to just come together for breakfast and 7:30 a.m., just a brief ad hoc work meeting in the dining hall just to see if there's any volunteers for working in the kitchen that day. Otherwise, people are welcome to join in with the meditations and with the retreat, which is just 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Tonight is a bit of an anomaly because it's the Wan Prat lunar observance, so that there's an evening puja at 7 and this Dhamma talk, but we won't have that on most of the other days. It'll just be 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., just a nice chunk of the day using the morning and afternoon periods as practice sessions, listening to teaching, sitting and walking meditation. So good opportunity to make use of that, and I won't go on for too long tonight. I'll leave it there for tonight.